Welcome to the podcast, Claim Your Excellent Life, with your host, Suzanne Kellner-Zink, where she helps professional women learn how to be happy. Suzanne will teach you how to do this through building high self-esteem, relaxation and calm, and good, healthy relationships. Tune in every week as Suzanne shares effective strategies to help you claim your excellent life with happiness techniques, self-esteem building exercises, relationship tips, and relaxation information. Make sure to head over to dawningvisions.com to subscribe to the newsletter to receive your keys to happiness, as well as other useful free gifts for you.
In this episode of Claim Your Excellent Life, we are going to be speaking about a humanistic take on autism and Asperger's. And my guest speaker, Dr. Jill Swartz, is going to tell us why autism and Asperger's is actually the same thing these days. So, first of all, Dr. Swartz, would you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about your background so that we understand who you are and where you're coming from? Most especially, how you got into this whole idea of autism and Asperger's, because you have a very interesting story in terms of your own expertise and how you got into it.
Yeah, I became interested in autism near the end of college. I was looking for a job, and a job came to me via an agency that does what's called applied behavioral analysis, which is typically the go-to method for treating people who have autism. Actually, I take that back. People are not people who have autism, autistic people. And I'll get to the distinction later and why that's important. A lot of people prefer people with autism. I don't, and I'll tell you why in a little bit.
Thank you.
It's a very important distinction. So I was doing applied behavioral analysis, and I really enjoyed working with the kids, and I really connected with them.
What is this applied behavioral?
Applied behavioral analysis is looking behaviorally at the kid and saying, what causes this behavior and what is reinforcing the behavior? It's very strictly behaviorist, you know, based on kind of the Skinner model.
Okay.
Using what's called operant conditioning. So what you might do is to get compliance, you might tell the child, sit down. If they don't sit down, you gently prod them down and give them a reward.
And what age group are we talking about?
2 through 15. Basically. Okay. So the youngest kid I work with would be 2 years old. And then you would do discrimination training, which is one card is blue, one card is red, and you say, touch red. Nope, touch red. Yes, here's your candy or soda or licorice or whatever it is.
Reward.
here's your reward, yes. And so I did that for a couple of years, about a year and a half. While I was on that job, I would go to various meetings, and I'd meet people, and I met the woman and her autistic son, who would eventually become my wife and stepson. That was to come much later. I ended up going to grad school in New York City, leaving California. We did the long-distance thing after a while. We were first friends. Got to know her kid really well. We connected immediately. Just a really great, solid relationship. I adore that kid, even though he's a nasty teenager now.
How old was he at the time?
5.
Okay.
Yeah. I really like that kid. Where was I? So then I went to college, and we talked about in our last podcast about how I did this kind of radical change from being a behaviorist, a cognitive behavioral therapist, to a more humanistic therapist through my own journey, through my own traumas, getting through life in my own way. I took a year off between finishing classes and going to internship because I had some work to do on various things. Mm-hmm. And during that year, I worked in a school in New York City that was doing the applied behavior analysis model. And at this point, I had been doing, you know, psychotherapy and deep emotional work for a while. I couldn't do ABA anymore.
Because?
I found it to be anti-humanistic. Very mildly abusive. There's some controversy to this thought. And I'll get into it in a little bit why I feel that way. But the moment that really changed me was there was a young lady in the class, and one of her behavioral goals was to not flap her hands when she was emotional because it made her look autistic and weird. And the goal of applied behavior analysis is to make autistic people look as neurotypical as possible. That is the stated goal of applied behavioral analysis.
Neurotypical meaning normal.
Non-autistic.
All right, go ahead.
Is what that usually means.
Okay.
Although non-neurotypical might be somebody with maybe some ADHD or some kind of like schizophrenia spectrum stuff. So basically, you know, that whatever the culture decides is the normal neurology for
right.
people to have. And so this young girl who struggled with math as well got an A on a math test. And was like, look what I did, and jumped and shook her hands. And the behavioral therapist ran in, put her hands down, and said, no hands, her hands down. And my heart broke.
Because?
This girl was embodying herself, embodying her happiness in a real, good, authentic way, and just reveling in the fact that she had done it, something that was difficult to do. And the therapist shamed her. I don't think he meant to. She had meant to. But that's what I saw. I saw her eyes go down. I saw her hide her face a little bit. And I said, I can't do this anymore.
Now, this is very important because we're talking about a normal, natural excitement.
Yes.
For something that was exciting because it was something that this kid accomplished that was so hard for her. And yet the emotions are being shut down.
Right.
And we're talking about needing to be emotionally healthy. And here we're shutting them down because of this thing called a behavioral therapy, quote unquote, that's supposed to be helpful.
Correct.
So there's
correct.
A conflict here in terms of what is healthy and what's not healthy.
Right, right. And I'll backtrack a little by saying that for certain things like self-injurious behaviors and basic communication skills, something like ABA can be, that's short for applied behavioral analysis, can be an incredibly useful tool. So we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Along these lines, you know, I kind of had this change of mind. And then I was involved in the autism world by way of, you know, my stepson. I had some acquaintances who were diagnosed later in life on the autism spectrum, and they never knew it.
Because later in life, meaning what ages, approximately?
Like 30 to 50.
Wow, that is later in life. Go ahead.
And I became really interested in those who were missed because the diagnostic criteria was so stringent in the way it was defined. In the previous DSM, which came out in the 90s, there were these four distinct disorders of autism. There was autism, there was Asperger's, there was Rett's, and there was something called pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, which doesn't quite fit into any of these categories, but we still think there's probably some autistic stuff going on.
And what's Rett's?
It's kind of like a late onset,
okay.
If I remember correctly. I could be wrong about that. I haven't gone over my DSM-4 in a very long time. Anyways, the DSM-5 came out a few years ago, and they changed it all into just autism spectrum disorder. And got rid of the Asperger's label and got rid of these other labels. And it's just one big spectrum. It's one thing that the DSM did right. I'm a huge critic of the DSM, but in terms of autism, I think that's one that they got absolutely correct.
And a reason for that is?
Because these artificial distinctions of autism versus Asperger's, high functioning, low functioning, create a false hierarchy. And it's almost like, and I get it, a lot of people had formed support groups and an identity around this idea that I have Asperger's. But I think subtly what that communicates is I'm higher functioning than an autistic person. You have autism. I have Asperger's. That's probably not accurate for everybody, but breaking down these hierarchies, I think, is a healthier way to look at it. And I think the research and the history of this variant of being human, I think, supports that idea that it's much more of a spectrum with, and it may not even be a single spectrum, but, you know, a couple of different spectrums interacting is a far more useful way to look at this phenomena than as a, you know, distinct types of diagnoses. And one of the reasons why a lot of people were missed is because of the inflexibility of the diagnostic criteria. So you had a lot of people who were clearly autistic as children and maybe coped with it later in life in a way that they no longer looked autistic, but they were still suffering internally very much because of it.
Can you talk about the sufferings internally, like how they experienced mm-hmm. that?
Yeah. People with autism have hyper-connected brains. So people who are neurotypical, our sensory modalities are very separate. I experience smell with this part of my brain. I experience touch with this part of my brain. I experience sight with this part of my brain. and my logical capacities are in this part of my brain. People with autism have a lot of crosstalk between these modalities. So they experience life in an incredibly intense and chaotic way. And the way that neurotypical people might make sense of experience, might mediate their experience through thought and association and meaning, tends to be a little bit different for people with autism, because it's kind of like everything happens at once instead of in these various parallel or hierarchical processes in which processing occurs in neurotypical brains.
So could you give like an example of what someone who you know who is dealing with a situation, what they're actually experiencing, like how they explain to you what's going on?
Oh yeah, I got a great example. So somebody very close to me, I showed them a post on Facebook around Halloween where somebody had made a giraffe costume, and they had used crutches for the legs and had done some body paint. And I saw the gestalt of this, and I thought, oh my God, that's so cute. Mm. That is adorable. Look what this young girl did. The person who had autism recoiled and went, ah. I said, why'd you do that? She goes, well, the crutches stood out first and reminded me of somebody who is, you know, disabled or hurt. And then I looked up and I saw this blotch on her skin and it made me think of skin cancer. And then I zeroed out more and I saw that her face was orange and people's faces shouldn't be orange. But now that I look at it better, I see, yeah, that's kind of cute. But for her to get there, she had to go through all these different layers of the senses and the associations kind of coming together in this intense fashion.
Because they tend to interpret stuff quite literally.
Correct, correct.
Which also is a problem because the nuances are gone.
The nuances are gone, right. So if you imagine somebody who experiences life in that way all the time, there's just so much noise going on in their brains at any given moment that it's really overwhelming. And that's really all autism is. Everything else that we see, the self-stimulatory behaviors, the excessive focuses, the literal way of thinking, is more of a response to that type of brain than it is the actual autism itself.
So when you're treating these people, mm-hmm. what is the best way to do this? And I want to bring up something with you that I've noticed with the two cases that I have. Mm-hmm. 18-year-old teenager as well as a 19-year-old teenager, mm-hmm. both female. In this case, they both have horrible short-term memory to the point where both of them were not mm-hmm. handing in homework. Sometimes it was done, many times it wasn't.
Right.
And their parents would ask them what they did in school, and they couldn't remember what they did in school that day. And so this whole idea of this lack of short-term memory, how do you work with that to help mm-hmm. these folks to be able to work in the society and be able to deal in the society? Because if you can't remember what you did from one thing to the next, and they're always like living in the now almost, how do you create functionality in our world?
So one thing that I'd like to throw in a little bit of a challenge, there's a popular phrase in the autism world of when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person.
Right.
That, yes, there are some overlaps in the ways that the brain works and in the intensity of certain experiences, but really the differences in personality and cognitive abilities are as varied as anybody else. You can have very extroverted autistic people and very introverted autistic people. You can have people with incredible short-term memory and those who can't do it at all. So I would say that might be more of those individuals than it is of actual autism.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I know autistic people who have the most profoundly amazing short-term memory that I've ever seen, and even better long-term memories.
Any hints as to how to help these folks with this really bad short-term memory do better?
The number one, you're actually right. So working memory might be impacted, and sometimes we confuse working memory and short-term memory.
Because the long-term memory is really excellent, especially in the things that they're very interested in. But
yes.
Just remembering what they were told or whatever, they'll hide for days because they can't remember, and then they're being blamed for not being able to remember stuff that they should have been able to remember, like simple stuff, like do something in the house or whatever.
So if you think of it in terms, again, from these people's experience.
Yes.
And you have a brain that is hypersensitive, wired, cross-wiring, right. Firing all over the place.
Too much stimulation.
Too much stimulation, and just normal life stimulation. So being out on a sunny day can be extremely intense for individuals. And if your cognitive resources are being allocated to protecting yourself from the sun and managing basic social conventions of, oh, I need to say hello now because that person said hello and it doesn't occur to me to say hello.
Right.
So all of your cognitive demands are for fending off the world and trying to look like you're neurotypical. And if all of your cognitive resources are being put to this and you have none left for self-care, for managing the anxiety of regular stress that comes out in life.
Social graces.
Social graces for remembering things that you're told in a classroom. There's just no resources left. So the number one intervention before I do anything with individuals with autism is I help them get their world under sensory control. So one of the things that we'll do is when I work with somebody with autism, I take them around my office and I say, is this light too bright for you? Is this texture too difficult for you? Are there any smells in here that you can't stand? And then once so some have me point the light one way, some of them I turn off the light, some of them I put my trash can outside. But once we get the environment under sensory control, they're very good learners and avid learners. They can do it really well. I also give them permission to not look neurotypical. If they want to sit here and flap their hands for an hour, I'll join them.
Right.
I'll sit right next
to
them.
Very freeing, right?
And flap your hands. It feels good.
Right.
Yeah. So I had one client who was so just emotionally, he actually said, I think my problem is that I'm Spock. I don't have emotions. I said, you do have emotions. You just don't know about them.
Right.
You don't know how to label them. And I tried so many different ways of talk therapy. Nothing was working. And so one day I'm like, I'm bored of this office. Let's go downstairs to the parking lot. What do you want to do? He goes, what do you mean what I do? I said, you know, most autistic people like to do weird things with their hands or their bodies. What do you want to do? And he goes, I want to do this. And he did this weird hand movement. I said, okay, so do it. He did it and he started laughing. I'm like, do it again. And then I did it with him. And then we ran around the parking lot 3 laps doing this weird hand motion over and over again. And it just opened him up.
Right, because you're meeting him where he's at.
Right.
Instead of condemning him for what comes naturally to him.
Exactly, exactly. Right. So a lot of it is just kind of self-advocacy. We read blogs together by other autistic people. And to backtrack a bit, one of the reasons why I became kind of a critic of ABA is there are a lot of blogs out there of autistic people who were raised under ABA.
Right.
And maybe are even continue to be nonverbal, but they can write and they have average to extreme intelligence, they just can't talk.
Right.
And when they write about their experiences, it's clear that to them it was damaging. It was clear that to them it was abusive. And one time I asked my stepson, who did go through years of ABA, I said, you know, what was that like for you? And he said, it was nice having people at the house, but all I remember is they made me do things I didn't want to do for years.
So how do you get these folks who are so hyper intensely involved in whatever that thing is, like mm-hmm. this one client of mine really into her snails, another one like really into mm-hmm. her iPad or her iPhone. How do you get them to be interested in other things mm-hmm. that might be a little bit more productive for them?
You try to use what they have and move it into a productive area. So your person likes snails. Maybe we can expand the interest from snails to other bugs and creepy crawlies, and there's a career in entomology there.
Right.
One of the things that we constantly see is that pretty much any scientist who has made an innovation was probably on the spectrum. Any engineer who made a major intervention, probably on the spectrum.
Because they have to be so aligned with what they're doing and that purpose, right?
Right. I mean, they say that Albert Einstein and Isaac Newton were on the spectrum. It's that intense focus and being able to see things in a really interesting, weird way that gives them the ability to make changes in the world.
Which normal, quote-unquote, people
mm-hmm.
have no understanding. They can't even perceive it.
Right.
And this is the interesting thing, because when the client of mine who's really involved with the snails, she her mother understands that she perceives things in such a different way than normal people and so much mm-hmm. deeper and more profound.
Yes.
But yet has this idea that she needs to fit into normal society's idea of what normal society is.
Right. So I'll give you another example. My own stepson, I call him my son by now. I've known him for 12 years, and he calls me dad. So he was one of these kids, a lot of autistic kids like to watch things spin. They'll like look at it at the corner of their eye and spin wheels, or they like marbles or something about that experience, which is really interesting to them. And he was definitely one of these kids. And he turned that into a fascination with bowling. He actually has a perfect 300 game.
Wow.
He routinely scores in the 220 to 260 range. No bumpers. And he is actually in junior professional leagues and tournaments. And he's won a few hundred bucks doing this.
Wow.
And when I asked him about what it's like for him bowling, there's a couple of things. So one thing is my wife told him, stop looking at the scores. You're at the other kid's scores. You're going to make yourself nervous. And he said, I don't need to look at the scores. She said, what do you mean? And he says, I can tell which pins fell down just by hearing it.
Wow. Hypersensitivity.
Right. So he can hear that 8 pins fell for that one. And then the other thing that I asked him about is when you're bowling, why is it so fascinating to you? And what he basically responded was the way that the light hits the ball as it spins down the lane is almost like watching fire, like watching sparks. So the way that a neurotypical person might get lost in a campfire, in a light show, in like a Pink Floyd laser light show.
They're very mesmerizing.
It's mesmerizing.
Hypnotic.
Right. For him, he gets to have that experience all the time. And how wonderful for him.
Absolutely.
How beautiful.
Yeah,
it's like being, it's almost euphoric.
Right.
It's like being, you know, on like a shroom kind of kick, but without actually being on it. So
yeah,
it's
brain doing it for you.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
The distinction that you wanted to make was about autism versus people with autism.
Yes.
Please talk about this.
So for years coming up through the, you know, autism advocacy groups that I was part of, the idea was you used person-first language, and this is big in the disabilities community. So you have people who are blind, not a blind person.
Mm-hmm.
You have a person with schizophrenia, not a schizophrenic, right? And the same logic applied to a person with autism. And what a lot of autism advocates came out and said is, autism, A, is not a disability. It's not a disease. That's your interpretation. And there's no separating the autism from me. The autism is my neurology. It is my brain. You can make me look like a neurotypical person, but I'm still autistic. My brain still acts like an autistic brain. There's no getting rid of the autism. So I am not a person with autism. I am an autistic person, just like I am a Jewish person, just like somebody might be a, an African-American. They're not a person with Africa. Africanism. It's a part of who they are. It's an intrinsic part of their identity. And by using the person-first language, a lot of people feel like neurotypical people are pathologizing them, saying that I have a disability, instead of honoring that this is in fact an integral and important part of who I am that comes with a lot of strengths.
So it's about honoring that these experiences that they have, mm-hmm, as a result of having this neurology, mm-hmm, is a part of who they are, needs to be honored, and which means really respected for what it is, yeah, and to stop making it be something bad or wrong or something that needs to be shifted and changed, because I'm okay with what I'm doing, using my brain the way that it's supposed to be working.
Right.
Because
right.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
It's my nature.
Right. And literally. I fully understand if you have a child with who's autistic, who is throwing tantrums and destroying shops, and I've worked with kids like that,
mm-hmm,
that isn't something that you can easily respect. But what you can try to get is, why is this happening? What is the sensory environment or the change, or what is it that they're reacting to? And if you go to it from that area, it's a much more meaningful intervention than just holding them down until they acquiesce, which is what ABA does.
Right. I know that one of the things that I've done that's worked really well with my clients, especially because both of them have really bad short-term memory, like mm-hmm, mm-hmm, from one moment to the next, is that I'll ask them, all right, so this is our issue. So for one of them, I know that their biomes are different, mm-hmm, and that they're missing one of the natural normal flora bugs that we need to keep us, mm-hmm, healthy.
Gut problems go hand in hand with autism. We don't quite know why.
They do.
But gut problems seem to be very, very important.
So diet.
Probably because both have something to do with serotonin issues, and serotonin is really big in the gut and in the brain. But that's not everything, obviously.
Well, This is true, and they need to have a decent diet. They cannot eat artificial anythings.
A lot, that's true.
Caffeine is problematic, seemingly, for at least one of mine, with heart racing and things like this, with these energy drinks that are all over the place, and having Mountain Dew on top doesn't necessarily help. And we talked about, you know, if your heart is going that fast, do you really want a heart attack at the age of 19? Not really. Or 18 in this case. So, you know, you can educate. And if it's profoundly emotional enough to strike into the memory, it will last. So what I do is I take them in the moment and I ask them, what do we need to do in order for you to be able to do what you need to do to be healthy and to have your mind work as well as you can allow it to work?
I love it.
By
yeah.
feeding it the right foods and doing what you need to do to help yourself.
Perfect.
And they'll tell me. And now sometimes they'll tell me false things because I know that their parents have already tried to get them to take notes and stuff, and that doesn't work because they won't take the notes. Okay, what else worked? And in this case, it was post-it notes. So what I did was I had this person's guardian. She was their guardian. I had them on the phone because it was an SOS call from the guardian saying that she was irritable, not sleeping, etc. And found out that she had had the Mountain Dew on top of the energy drink. So I had the conversation with the kid. And then I put the guardian on the line. I said, look, this is what I want you to do. We were talking about post-it notes. I want you to sit down with her, and I want you to do it immediately now so she doesn't forget, because she has agreed that this will help. And if you do it now, she will be compliant and do it with you because she doesn't want to have these ill effects happen again. It's scary.
Right.
So, but if you wait 10 minutes, she may forget because this is the history. So we need to do it now. So I texted the guardian a few hours later. I said, how did it work? She said, it worked very well.
Good,
more than
good.
Interested in doing it. And we got it done. And then I heard from the male part of the family guardian, yes, we have notes all over the kitchen now as reminders.
Good,
and
good.
I ever had her put a label on the back of her iPhone to remind her when she's out with her friends and stuff, you need to be aware of what you are ingesting because your body and your mind will not work the way that you would like them to
right.
if you're eating this
right.
crap, for example.
And you know, speaking of food, because people with autistic people, see, I still make the mistake. I was so programmed the other way. Autistic people are incredibly hypersensitive, and their neurology is. So they can react very strongly to chemicals and food and to caffeine and psych drugs as well. They tend to need a lot less to have a noticeable effect. Also, it can just wreak havoc on their systems, which is why the diagnosis part of this is really important. And a kind of subspecialty in this that I do is working with less affected autistic women. It's a population that has been missed. They don't fit the diagnostic criteria for many reasons. I have a blog on LinkedIn for more information if you want to read it. But what it boils down to is they're more socially motivated, so they can fake being neurotypical better. And as a result, a lot of professionals miss it. But they're still very emotional. They're still really sensitive. So oftentimes they're mislabeled with bipolar, or they're mislabeled with borderline personality disorder and given meds that just wreak havoc on their system when it's really autism. And if you go back in their histories, they were lining things up and hand flapping and turning in circles and burying themselves under blankets. But as they got older, they learned to kind of fake the funk.
Gotta love it. So what is the name of that LinkedIn?
If you just look up Joel Schwartz's ID on LinkedIn, you'll see that I wrote a blog there about it that goes through what one should look for if you're a female with autism, an autistic female, and why the diagnostic criteria has missed a lot of these women.
You know, this is like so important because we have more and more people being diagnosed with this stuff. Now, let me ask you this question. Do you think that it's being overdiagnosed to some degree?
No.
You don't. You just think that a lot of it's being found that we just didn't understand before because we're starting to understand what the issues are that
Folks
are dealing with now.
Absolutely. And the fact is that there are millions of autistic people who have learned to cope, and they do great in Silicon Valley or as scientists or as air traffic controllers or any other job that takes any sort of focus or repetitive action. And they've always been with us. They're kind of weird and they're quirky and they have a great job. And, oh, that's just Uncle Aaron, you know?
How do they find employers that will be able to work with them in terms of understanding what they really need for an environment that will work for them?
Well, a lot of them just self-select into jobs that already are that way, like an engineering person or a software developer. But there are now, with the knowledge of these strengths, there are companies out there that are specifically looking for people, for autistic people to do their jobs. So Microsoft is looking for autistic people. There's a company in Culver called MindSpark, I think, and they specifically hire autistic people to do software stuff. In Israel, interestingly, there is an entire division of their intelligence unit that is autistic,
wow,
who spend their time scanning satellite images because they can see the little differences that happen and say, oh, there's movement happening here. So they have taken, you know, individuals with autistic individuals, even ones who would be considered, you know, low functioning or, you know, having other mental issues, and giving them a job and a place to be and a way to contribute in a meaningful way. And they love it.
Because I can just focus on that one thing. Yeah. They're good at it.
Yeah, yeah. So there is a place in society for autistic people. Even, you know, many farmers, you till your land over and over again and look at the little interesting things in the in the plants and diagnose a gardening issue. That's a place for autistic people to really thrive. There are so many areas of society where autistic individuals can do amazing things.
Let me ask you this question. Is, I know that in one of the families I'm working with, the kid could work with her guardian,
mm-hmm,
doing a pretty simple job. But more often than not, she'll say she's tired or she doesn't want to do it,
mm-hmm,
and is not interested and isn't really interested in doing, I think, most things that have to do with work at all. And this,
yeah,
is something I hear,
yeah,
from the other one, doesn't want to do work, you know, what they see as work. So what is the motivation, or how do you create a motivation there that is ecological, meaning good for them,
mm-hmm,
good for the other person who needs the work done, and for the environment in general, to help them to understand, you know, basic life learning skills in terms of, you know, these are the things that employers expect, and this is what you need to do. And even if you don't feel like doing it, you know, you need to do these things in order to be able to work in the work world.
Right, right. It's very difficult, and here's why. And this is similar with kids with ADHD,
mm-hmm,
as well. When your entire school history is aversive to you, that sitting down to do work is the opposite of the way your brain works, of course you're not going to ever want to do work, because every experience you've had is like an electric shock. So if every time that a mouse sits down to eat something and you give it an electric shock, it's going to go hungry, and there's almost no way to reverse that, you know, without some intense behavioral interventions. So a lot of these people, that's exactly what it is. Doing work has been coupled with shock over and over and over again. So even the idea of sitting down to do work in a conventional way is just anxiety provoking and aversive, and they just can't do it. So the only way around it is to help them figure out their own buy-in, to find out, what are your goals? Do you want friends? Well, then you have to shower.
Right.
You have to shower. You know, if you don't want to shower, go out and try to make friends. See what happens. What's the feedback you get? Oh, they told me I was the smelly kid. Do you want to be the smelly kid? No, then take a freaking shower. Well, it hurts me to take a shower because I have sensory issues. And that's what happens to a lot of kids,
right,
is they have sensory issues. So if that's the case, we go back to the drawing board. And the number one thing to do with people, with autistic people, is to help them with their sensory stuff. Because once the sensory stuff is under control, they're very good learners.
Okay, so my other question too, because I know that they mature,
mm-hmm,
slower than what we consider normal,
sure,
for whatever these reasons are, probably with all the sensory overkill,
yeah,
in their systems.
Well,
so
well, also it depends
hard
on the whole idea of maturity is kind of a social construction, right?
This is true. Well, we're talking about the, okay, so we'll talk about societal expectations of a mature person versus someone who just,
correct,
wants to do what they want to do.
Correct,
right?
Yeah. But again, what's wrong with it? A lot of scientists are very childlike in their presentation. We call it, oh, the absent-minded professor. But damn, are they getting stuff done. And, you know, they're making innovations and they're printing papers. And, you know, they're weird and quirky and immature, but so what?
So it's really just a matter of having them help you figure out how it can work best for them. It's really what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of anything other than that. It's just going back and saying, okay, this is not working for you. What will work better for you?
Right, right.
And then helping them to adjust what they need so that it will work for them in the environment, so they're not feeling overly stimulated in a negative way,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
so they can be stimulated in a positive way.
Right. Where it gets very difficult is because most of their interactions with authority figures, helpers, teachers have been against their baser natures or basic natures.
Right.
There's often an issue of really not trusting the system and not wanting to participate in it. And sometimes that work can be very long and hard to rebuild that trust, because one of the hallmarks of being autistic is being kind of inflexible in thinking.
Of course.
You get an idea and you stick with it.
Right.
And it's very hard to change. So oftentimes that's where the more intense psychotherapy and relationship building is really necessary. And that can be a very long process, especially if the person is still a teenager.
Right.
Because teens don't trust authority anyway.
Right. Well, they're trying to individuate themselves anyway and
right.
figure out who the hell they are.
Exactly.
That's a big part of it.
So that just adds the beautiful complexity.
So if someone is being told that college is important, mm-hmm. and yet this person with autism.
Autistic person.
Or autistic person. There you go. Thank you. It says, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I understand that's important. And yet I'm fearful of it because I already failed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to do what you're asking me to do
because
you helped me all these years by doing it for me.
Right.
Than anything else, and not allowing me to fail and learn from my failures, you know, to learn how to overcome these things. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that situation?
Sometimes getting out of the home that created this situation in the first place can be a life changer. Sometimes it can lead to further failure. Most good colleges have recognition of autistic neurology and what needs to happen. And unfortunately, it's listed under students with disabilities. And as you know, I don't buy that it's a disability.
Right.
Disability is a value judgment.
Yes.
Although certainly a lot of people with more severe autistic tendencies can be very disabled in their day-to-day interaction. That being said, that a lot of colleges have services. In California, we have the regional centers. The regional centers have things like student housing that is facilitated, which can be great. So you can live on your own, but you get checked up on. And they're making sure your daily living skills and your cleaning up and things are actually happening.
Would this work for a person who really thinks of that as being treated like a disabled person, quote unquote, and doesn't want to be there with those people, those problems, as I see it? That's their language and not mine.
I've encountered that, and I like to look at it as analogous to internalized racism or internalized sexism.
Mm-hmm.
For the listeners, what that essentially means is when you grow up, so say that you're a black person,
mm-hmm.
and you grow up in a society that systematically belittles you, systematically distrusts you, systematically oppresses you, and you know, bars you from entry. You can internalize some of that. And, you know, you might hear it in things like, well, I'm not one of those black people. And that is kind of an internalized message of, oh, there are those type of black people. So you've internalized some of that racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people with disabilities or even autistic people have internalized this idea that I don't want to be like those autistic people. I just want to be like mine. Which is where that whole like Asperger's autism
right.
thing comes back into is, oh, I'm much better than that. I don't want to look at that part of myself and ask for help.
And so, that's another problem, because they don't ask for help.
Right. Well, when they've asked for help, people have helped them in a way that's been hurtful.
Right.
So, of course, they're not going to ask for help. So, it's building the relationship and showing that you're doing it from a benign place and that you're a reliable person.
Right. Because this is also a very important point, because one of the kids was talking about, and I had her mother there, and I pointed this out to her, Mom, you know, your kid just said something really important. What she said was, when I ask for help, I'm asking for emotional help, not academic help.
There you go. Right.
And the differentiation of one person's assumption mm-hmm. not matching mm-hmm. the receiver's need and
right,
desire.
Right. And our neurotypical assumptions of life are often spit in the face of the way that autistic people need to be. You know, back to at the beginning of our conversation, I talked about this young lady who was hand flapping in class.
Yes.
Why does she need to not hand flap? Who's uncomfortable with that and why? If she's out in public and she hand flaps and a couple of people look at her like she's weird, so?
Exactly. Who cares? She's not hurting anybody.
Right. You know, people can go out now in public wearing a dress, and if you're a man, or you can, you know, be a transgender person, or you can go out wearing punk rock clothes if that's your identity.
Right.
And, you know, some people might look at that a little bit sideways, but, you know, we're not going to force the person to not be who they are if we're compassionate.
And that's a very important word right there, compassion.
Yes.
Because what is the difference between being compassionate and being overwhelming in terms of you forcing your agenda on this other person because you care so much about them being successful, quote unquote, whatever
right,
that means
right.
in your world, not necessarily their world.
Well, that is a universal problem in America, I feel. One of the greatest books ever written is called Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller, in which she talks about the soul damage that can happen from parents projecting their expectation onto kids. And this isn't just autistic people. This is all of us.
Right.
Anybody who's raised with a parent who their expectations are more important than who the child actually is. Alice Miller in the book wrote, you know, there are two types of parents. There are parents who say, I dream that you are going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or this, or that, or the other. And there are parents who say, I can't wait to see what you're going to become. And the difference in that.
So huge.
It's huge. And we've normalized the former as just the way that we are in America. And it leads to narcissistic kids. It leads to kids who aren't able to understand who they are. They have a false idea of who they are, which is really what narcissism is about. It's about being unable to be authentic and having this false self that is predominant. And when we've only reinforced the false self at the expense of the true self, you have a lot of different negative things that happen.
Such as
distrust of authority, such as not being able to label your emotions, such as being inflexible in thinking. And again, this is everybody, not just autistic people.
Well, I'm talking about the narcissism, and, you know, to give kind of a definition of that, because people have, like, really weird ideas of what narcissism is, because
mm-hmm.
they don't know. These are
right.
just terms that are thrown around, like OCD. People don't even know what these things mean. Go
well,
ahead.
Like,
what's narcissism?
Like anything, it's a spectrum.
Yes, we know. Now, after talking
yeah,
with you.
Right. There are people who have the diagnosable narcissistic personality disorder who might look like certain politicians that we all can name. And then there are people who narcissism is really about what I said. It's they've developed a shell of a self that they show to the world. And when that self is challenged, they react with such intense negativity, heightened emotions, and they lose the ability to empathize with others in those moments.
They can be very controlling and
demeaning.
They
can be very controlling,
yes.
And they go through life manipulating so that other people can only see that part of them. Because to actually look at the real part that was never validated is really difficult and really painful.
It's scary.
It is. So to go back to autistic people, I see a lot of autistic people can have, especially in their, you know, teens and 20s, these narcissistic defenses of, I'm not going to, you know, do it any other way than the way I'm going to be. I'm not going
right.
to be flexible. I'm just going to do it my way because everything that you tell me is crap. And that's kind of a narcissistic defense.
Right.
And that develops from not being really seen and understood and heard. My son, for example, when we stopped the whole ABA thing and really started to appreciate who he is.
At what age did you do that?
Like 15, 16.
Okay, go ahead.
15 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
14, 15. He's 17 now. He's delightful. Like, yes, he has his annoying teenage moments of, you know, I'm going to be, you know, I know better than you. I'm a teenager, which I'm all going to have.
Right.
But there's no narcissism there at all. Like, he's a much better sport than I am. Like, he can take a whooping in a card game and be like, oh, that was fun. Whereas, like, I'm actually hurting a little bit.
Oh, my. Imagine.
And like, he's just who he is. And it's so great. And he's been able to maximize, you know, his life because of it.
I have one more issue that comes up a lot. And it's not just with people with autism, but I find it a lot with female teen 20-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
30-year-olds, even older women who haven't ever had treatment for their issues, where the mother comes in and has to supersede, and it's all about her and everything that she's done,
uh-huh.
or she'll do one-upmanship with the daughter
right.
to prove that she's more
right.
important in some fashion or form. So how do we help these kids deal with that kind of dynamic?
It's all in Alice Miller's book. Essentially what it is you really have to work with the parent as well. Sometimes a parent refuses to, in which case it's all about helping the kid get in contact with their true self, their emotions, and kind of saying to them, you know what, you can survive this, and when you're out on your own, you'll be okay. And giving them a different model.
Because this is, like, so very, very important.
Agreed.
You know, especially when I see people, like, in their 30s and 40s, and a lot of, I don't know, people with a lot of weight gain, protect themselves, or people, I'm trying to think back on the people that I had who had these particular problems, or the people with the dead emotions, many, many, many times, and even like the anorexic bulimics, you know.
I would say that anorexia is a bodily form of narcissism that arrives because of these similar things. There's a lot of theorists who feel the same way.
I agree with you 100% after working with them, and because they do, they get like very concrete, they get very rigid, and you know, it's all about occupying their brain so they don't deal with the stuff that they can't deal with, and perfectionism and all that stuff.
And because of those traits as well, there's actually quite a lot of overlap with anorexia and females with and autistic females. Quite a lot of them have eating disorders.
So you find that the treatment that you do for one really helps both because you have that big overlap, which is very fascinating.
Yeah. I tend not to do much work with eating disorders, not necessarily by choice. I'll see somebody unless they are, you know, in danger and they need a controlled environment.
Right.
But I do work with people who might have eating issues as part of a grander pathology, or I don't want to use the pathology, a grander difficulty, like maybe they were sexually abused as children, or maybe they had like a mild bipolar thing going on, so they overeat sometimes. But that's kind of a specialty area because there are a lot of medical issues and other things to be aware of. Yeah.
Most definitely. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating and truly helpful.
Sure thing.
Because if you can't ask people who have expertise and a different way of looking at the world, where are you going to get these nuances of understanding coming from?
Right.
Where?
Right.
I'm so happy that I met you and that we were able to have these dialogues, you know?
Likewise. This is really fun.
As I promised you it would be. Right? Because it's in letting people express what they've learned in their own course of life.
Yeah.
We're going to really get the meat as far as I'm concerned, you know? We can talk about all this licensure. We can talk about all this other theory and all this stuff. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
It is about the rapport, the relationship. It's about inner and outer understanding. Understanding where you are and who you are and where you came from and why and how that projects itself out into the world and how you want that to be reflected back versus maybe how it is. It may not be working so well for you in some situations.
Right.
Some interventions might be useful. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I can't thank you enough, Joel, for your time and your expertise.
You're welcome.
Anything else that you would like to add before we close?
Nothing comes to mind at the moment.
All right.
Thank you for the opportunity. I enjoyed this.
You're very welcome. If you think of anything else of any import, you just let me know because, as you see, it's a very simple thing to do.
All right.
All right?
Great.
Technology can be beautiful when it works.
Sure thing.
So, again, if you are a wellness professional, please sign up for the Dawning Visions Hypnosis Inc. newsletter because I am in the process of putting together an amazing training for all of you where you will learn how to let go of some of those things that may be getting in your way so you can bring out your best with your patients and clients and learn these tools and techniques in service to your patients and clients. Go to the website at dawningvisions.com, DAWNING, V as in Victor, IS as in Sam, IONS.com. For further information, it will be coming out in the next week or so if it's not already on the website by the time you listen to this. Dr. Joel Schwartz and I thank you for spending your time with us. Until next time.
Bye-bye.
If you have found the information that we have shared with you here on Claim Your Excellent Life to be helpful and interesting, please do us a favor of giving us a rating on iTunes. We hope it will be 5 stars, as well as a review. Doing both these acts will move the podcast up in the ratings on iTunes so more people will be able to find us. Also, please do us the favor of letting your friends and colleagues know about this podcast so they too can gain the knowledge that we're sharing here. We'd like as many people as possible to learn from what we have to give here. And we thank you for your time and effort in doing so.
Thank you for listening to the podcast, Claim Your Excellent Life, with your host, Suzanne Kellner-Zink, where she helps professional women learn how to be happy. Suzanne teaches you how to do this through building high self-esteem, relaxation and calm, and good, healthy relationships. Tune in every week as Suzanne shares effective strategies to help you claim your excellent life with happiness techniques, self-esteem building exercises, relationship tips, and relaxation information. Make sure to head over to dawningvisions.com to subscribe to the newsletter to receive your keys to happiness, as well as other useful free gifts for you.